here today, so we wanted to make sure that we took care of the recording. We record our services and they're available online. You can go back several years and hear sermons that you might have missed from all sorts of speakers, as well as ministers at White. Okay, well, it's Christmas time. You're probably seeing a lot of Jesus is the reason for the season kinds of posters and ads and letters to the editor and things like that. Sometimes people put those things up and we understand them or we misunderstand them. Do we have a picture up? I have a picture. It's not pleasant to be misheard, misread, or misunderstood, but it happens sometimes when you write a sermon or a newspaper column. The kind of thing you need to turn out at a fairly brisk rhythm. Every couple of weeks, every couple of days, such pieces usually get one reading or one hearing, and then it's over. People remember what they thought they heard you say, and then demand an apology. Or if you're lucky, they sometimes thank you for answering questions that you had no idea you were speaking to. And sometimes you get too comfortable with your audience and speak the way you might with friends or family. You know what I mean when I use this word or that expression? You know I'm kidding or using irony to make a point, right? Well, for example, my dad would often use an expression in his native language to get my attention. Faccia brutta. Che cosa fai? What are you doing? Faccia brutta. Get over here. Faccia brutta means ugly face. It came out of his own upbringing, an Italian folk tradition. You're supposed to be careful about praising what you love too openly, drawing attention to it. That could invite envy, or even worse, it could draw malocchio, the evil eye. Always put down what you love, at least a little, when others are listening. But unless I misheard him, my dad didn't really think that my face was ugly. I'm not so sure about Kathleen Parker. Her column headlined, "Jesus Didn't Need a New Face," appeared during our last right-wing political administration, when people felt emboldened to spout off about the other like they do today. You know, the capital O, other. People who aren't regular people like you and me. I cut the column out and kept it in a folder. It starts, "Well, there goes old Blue Eyes, not Frank Sinatra, Jesus. A new computer-generated face of Jesus based on probable Jewish features, skin color, and hair 2,000 years ago has ruined a million stained glass windows around the globe and left Christians of all races to worship someone they've never seen before. The willowy, long-haired figure who in picture books attracted children the way Cinderella drew flocks of bluebirds and singing rodents now looks like the kind of guy who wouldn't make it through airport security. His skin is darker, which makes sense given his geography. Ditto his black curly hair, but that jaw, the new JC looks like he's more likely to chomp down on a brontosaurus thigh than tackle loaves and fishes. And that nose, described on MSNBC website as stout, it looks more like a snout that snorts. Yo, Jimmy Durante, eat your heart out." You know Jimmy Durante? This might be a generational thing. Okay, you know that big-nosed old Italian guy? It almost makes me want to sing, "Rink, I ain't got to for you." But instead, let's hear Deborah play. Thank you. so much. Thanks so much. I like the, some of the silences and the soft dynamics. They really make you listen, you know? You get tired of listening to things that, that are loud all the time. Backtrack a little bit into that column. What? That's going to be interesting on the recording. Here we go. Well, there goes old Blue Eyes. A new computer-generated face of Jesus has ruined a million stained glass windows around the globe and left Christians of all races to worship someone they've never seen before. The willowy, long-haired figure who in picture books attracted children the way Cinderella drew flocks of bluebirds and singing rodents now looks like the kind of guy who wouldn't make it through airport security. Parker's creamy white face smiles from the top of her column with her fair hair and little button nose. Further down, we see the face she informs us was generated by a forensic artist who used a, quote, 2,000-year-old skull of a Jewish man from Israel and based hair and skin tone on 3rd-century frescoes of Jewish faces. The brows are heavier, the jaw more square, and the nose bridge slightly higher, but it's a face pretty much like mine, or Jimmy Durante's, I suppose, a typical face for a Mediterranean male even today. I can testify that it is the kind of face that can slow you down getting through airport security, especially when you add a beard. But Parker continues, I guess we should have figured that a guy born around today's Israeli-Palestinian border wasn't likely to look like a young James Taylor, all wispy and pale and blue-eyed, but that's the way he looked in all my childhood Bible storybooks. If you research images of Jesus throughout history, you'll see that he was not depicted in fair-haired Northern European form until fairly recently. He has been seen before with all sorts of hair and many different complexions, although Jesus' physical appearance seems to have been of little concern to early Christian writers. The only description we have is where the Gospel of Luke describes Jesus as big and strong. Not too surprising for somebody who probably worked construction. So Parker's wispy image contradicts both scripture and common sense. But now she elaborates. It's hard to suddenly embrace some new dude who looks mostly like my proctologist's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather after a visit to Carmen's hair salon and spa, or Charlie Manson's first cousin. Take your pick. What? All proctologists are Jews? And why does Parker choose proctologist out of all of the medical specialties she could have selected? Why, if not to suggest a connection between such textured brown features with human waste and where it passes through us? Why not ophthalmologist or dermatologist? Why not gynecologist? Jesus, after all, is remembered for some of his pioneering work in gynecology. I'm not saying this to shock or offend, but to recall one of the best-known healings of the New Testament stories. Parker says she can't reach out and embrace some new dude, but she doesn't know, but that's exactly what the woman in the crowd does in the gospel story that I'm about to tell. Jesus was moving through that crowd when a woman who had suffered a bloody discharge for 12 years, which no doctor had been able to cure, reached out and touched the edge of his cloak. She was healed instantly. Jesus stopped and asked, "Who was it that touched me?" And he explained to his disciples that he just felt power go out of him. The woman came forward and explained why she'd done it, and he said, "My daughter, your faith has cured you. Go in peace." Notice that he doesn't take credit for the healing. The woman's faith did it, first and foremost. Now back to Kathleen Parker and her proctologist. She writes about something that makes her uncomfortable, trying to imagine a Mideastern-looking Jesus. That brings to mind a kind of physical exam that gives everyone anxiety and discomfort, being touched where we're seldom touched by another, bringing light and sight to a part of us that usually stays dark. I can see why this would come to mind when thinking about Jesus. I can also understand using humor to mask one's discomfort at being known so deeply and intimately. And Parker continues, probably there's not a huge supply of 2,000-year-old Jewish skulls lying around from which to select a Jesus lookalike, but surely they could have found a better-looking noggin. A skull isn't just a skull. Surely there's a difference, say, between Brad Pitt's and Timothy McVeigh's skull, though the two men might be lumped together as similarly Aryan males 2,000 years from now. Given the tendency of academics to steer conclusions away from anything that might be construed as Aryan or, heaven forbid, Falwellian, it's easy to imagine that biblical revisionists won't be satisfied until they discover that Jesus was really a bisexual, cross-dressing, whale-saving, tobacco-hating, vegetarian African queen who went to the temple to lobby for women's rights. Let's stick with skulls and Jews and Aryans for a moment before considering whether anyone is trying to revise Jesus, as if Parker's blonde, blue-eyed Jesus was not one of an endless string of revisions. Why use the term Aryan for people who look like Brad Pitt, Timothy McVeigh, and yes, herself? That's not the only term that we have for people with such features, but it is the term preferred by Hitler and all the Nazi wannabes up to this present day. You will not replace us! Up to the present day. Those good people in the crowd. They have made available a huge supply of Jewish skulls, as well as the skulls of gay folks, gypsies, the mentally ill, and yes, some Unitarians. After first extracting their gold teeth, of course. Those empty tooth sockets might pose a mystery to forensic scientists of the future, but let's stick with the mystery at hand. Why is the otherwise squeamish Ms. Parker so comfortable with the term Aryan and all that it connotes? How does she jump from science revising an outdated picture of Jesus to biblical revisionism and changing common understandings of the life and teachings of the Jewish man who stars in the gospel stories? She now complains that a TV series that showcased the new image of Jesus doesn't stop with Jesus' physical characteristics. The filmmakers also probe such serious concerns as, was Jesus really born in a stable? Or was he really born in a cave? Did Judas really betray Jesus? Or was Jesus a co-conspirator aiming to get himself arrested? Sort of like Jesse Jackson does from time to time. Let's not go into why Ms. Parker chooses black Jesse Jackson rather than white Daniel Berrigan, for her example, as she complains about this suggestion that Jesus expected to be arrested. The gospel stories never portray Jesus as an innocent victim who is only trying to heal as many people as possible. Here he is, reminding his followers just before his arrest how they used to go unarmed to preach and cure disease. When I sent you out barefoot without purse or pack, were you ever short of anything? No, they answered. It's different now, he said. Whoever has a purse had better take it with him and his pack too. And if he has no sword, let him sell his cloak to buy one. For scripture says, and he was counted among the outlaws. And these words, I tell you, must find fulfillment in me. Look, Lord, they said, we have two swords here. Enough. Enough, he replied. No, two swords are not nearly enough to protect this small group of outlaws or to vanquish the Roman Empire. Two swords are just enough to guarantee state violence against you. Better to get rid of anything that even looks like a weapon if you're planning to plead innocent. This is one of many examples that show how Jesus knew his danger and walked right into it, Yes, like a co-conspirator aiming to get himself arrested. A simple reading of the text is enough to see this without any highfalutin academic research. After her crack about Jesse Jackson, Kathleen Parker goes on to joke, not to make light or dark of such serious scholarly research, but geez Louise, couldn't we have a holiday from iconoclasm? Would that be Easter?
Oh my gosh.
Or Christmas? How could such a holiday be a celebration of the life and teachings of Jesus? That dark, brawny outlaw was also an iconoclast from the word go. The word means one who favors the destruction of images, especially divine images. That's what Jesus came to do. Here's Luke's gospel again. Some people were talking about the temple of Jerusalem and the fine stones and offerings with which it was adorned. He said, "These things that you're gazing at, the time will come when not one stone of them will be left upon another. All will be thrown down." So he didn't go to the temple to lobby for gay whales. He went to lobby against the temple itself. For devotees of a religion that forbids graven images, the temple was the most important visual representation of God's power in the world. Now down it goes in the earthquake of Jesus' words. How do you think this sounded to the ordinary Jew in the street? Some might say, wow, but most would say, whoa, better watch your tongue and your back. Well, let us back up now to where Ms. Parker's images of proctology and dirt and darkness converge, and then we can wash up and go celebrate a nice white Christmas in the snow. This time the words are from the Gospel of Mark, and they explain what religious icon Jesus is playing havoc with so clearly that I don't need to. And when the Pharisees met him, they saw that some of his disciples ate with unwashed hands. And they asked him, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with hands defiled?" And he said to them, "Do you not see that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and so passes out into the drain? What comes out of a man is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a man." I don't want to sound too politically correct, but I'm pretty sure he meant this goes for a woman too. The great African-American preacher Howard Thurman is remembered for standing up one Sunday just to say, "There is no word from the Lord this morning," and then sitting down again. And this is counted as one of his triumphs. If he'd gone ahead and tried to speak without any sense of inspiration, his sermon might have been a disaster. I've had one or two of those myself. When you don't have much to say, but for reasons of pride or deadlines or not knowing what else to do, you go to fill a page or a pulpit anyway. What comes out of you is likely to be whatever happens to be passing through you at the time. A sample from your dark insides. Parker's pretty face appears at the top of her column, but it's an ugly face that's squeezed out when she's done. The pretty photo may be recent or come from some years past. The ugly face is one that we've seen for 2,000 years and more, wrapped around many skulls besides her no doubt delicate and shapely one. A pale mask floating over burning crosses, swastikas, piles of bodies turned to waste under its gaze. A face that smiles, secure in the knowledge that it's the best kind of face to have. One you'd never find on a bisexual, cross-dressing, whale-saving, tobacco-hating, vegetarian African queen who went to the temple to lobby for women's rights, even the right to not bleed forever for want of help or health care. She clings to an icon of her childhood, A blonde, wispy Jesus who looks like anything but a Mideastern man of his time, though we all know that he was one. She wants to love a face like her own. Surely the face of God turned human being must be a face like hers, so fair that like Cinderella's face, it would attract bluebirds and columns of singing white mice, not the sick, the blind, the dirty, and the poor. The face she can't love is the face of the other, with a strong jaw, biting teeth, and biting words, dark like the stuff we wish would vanish down the drain so we can forget where it came from, with a big nose pushing forward to examine us where we'd rather be left untouched, unknown. It's a face that knows dark places. We know that neither God nor a fully human being can have Cinderella's fairy tale innocence. But Parker wants to see a face that's clean, pale, and pure, with nothing dark, nothing else, nothing other in the mix. All self, no other. Who is the other? The other with the big O. Oh, what will happen if she or he or it sniffs me out and sees me in the corners and cubby holes where I hide my secret hopes and fears? Who would want to do such a thing to me? Maybe there is someone. Or maybe there is no other at all. Maybe I'm just reaching for an empty cloak or running to escape an empty pair of pants, like the boy in our children's story. Maybe the other is really just what's hidden in those dark, secret places where I also hide myself. Or maybe the other is my own fear of change and my hope that I can survive it. The other is my fear of change and my hope I can survive it. I can survive it. If you can be other than me and survive and thrive, then there's hope that I can too. I can become in some ways other than I am. You mean that much to me, if nothing else. You are living proof that I can change. But this can be true only if we assume there's something that's already the same about both of us. No matter the difference in complexion, hair texture, or the relative size of our noses. Maybe this, maybe that. I know I haven't really told you anything about how to get out of your own head and have some kind of real, authentic meeting with the others around you. I haven't figured out how to do it myself yet. Will it be like seeing a human face for the first time, or the face of God? Would I even know the difference between those two? I can't claim to be a Christian, but if the main point Jesus was trying to get across didn't have something to do with this meeting, and that it's hard, and that it's healing, and that we have to try, then I'm no closer to understanding his teachings than I was before. I know I can't solve this problem for Kathleen Parker. Maybe somebody with an ugly face like this will do that for her, or her faith in him will make her whole. Maybe it's already happened. I've seen a lot of changes in her columns over the years since she wrote this one. Change can happen. Change can happen. Cue the bluebirds and singing mice. Cinderella's stories are oh so nice. Hallelujah. There's not much more I can tell you about this kind of thing for certain, but I can tell you what I hope. If I ever do manage to get past the limits of my own Mediterranean skull and really face the mystery of an other, I hope I'll find a friend like the boy with the pants. I hope you find one too. So may it be.